May it please the Court, my name is Scott Sugarman. I am counsel for Joshua Harvest. With the Court's permission, I would request 2 minutes reserved for a rebuttal.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I would submit to you that the central question before this Court can be reduced to several core propositions. First, Joshua Harvest initiated a habeas proceeding challenging the constitutionality of his murder conviction. The State opposed it. This Court agreed with the challenge he made and granted habeas, and both this Court and the District Court ordered the State to release him unless it initiated proceeding within 60 days. Indeed, the Court's order provided two requirements. One, to do that, release if he is not, within 60 days they did not do one or the others. And secondly, the Court's order instructed the State to send a notice of compliance within 60 days. It is unquestioned that the State did nothing. It, as it said in its own brief, had no good reason to let the time lapse. It was within its power to comply. It simply did nothing. So I submit respectfully that the issue before you is whether the State is bound by the rule of law or may it disregard with impunity this Court's rulings and the rulings of the District Court.
Well, it's not quite so stark because, as I understand it, there seem to be two lines of cases. Do you agree with that?
If the Court, Your Honor, if you're asking me whether there are two lines of cases that say the conditional writ becomes an unconditional writ and a second line that say the State may go in and seek relief, I would agree.
All right.
And but even if
– So if the second line of cases is the law, then the State had the right to do what it did, right?
Respectfully, no. What the State
– The seeking relief would be under – is there common ground in this case? I'm a little confused. That this is 60B or nothing, or is there some other possibility? In other words, that this has to be – that what the State did, although it didn't say it's what it was doing, had to be done under Rule 60B and should be measured by the standards of Rule 60B. Is that your position, first of all?
The State, in fact, did say – either 60B or the general equitable principles under habeas. It referred to both in its brief. But it seemed to be saying, and he did say, that even if it goes under the general equitable principles, it still had to show excusable neglect to seek relief after the 60 days expired.
The district court didn't really did it view the issue as being with an excusable neglect issue? Applying the 60B standards and Pioneer and all that, it didn't really say.
The Court is correct. The district court had a one-page order, which is, I believe it's on page 80 or so of the excerpt of record, Your Honor, in which there was no citation of authority. Indeed, the Attorney General in its briefs didn't argue the standards set, as you say, in Pioneer or in this Court's opinion in Pinkay and the other cases cited in my briefs here. There is no substantive discussion of them. But in fairness, I must note that in the first sentence of the second paragraph, the district court said, I find excusable neglect. That's correct. But without any consideration of the relatively elaborate discussions that have occurred both in the U.S. Supreme Court and in this Court about what it means.
But I think what Judge Tashima was referring to is then there are a bunch of cases in other circuits that have just done this, haven't cited 60B, have just done it. How do you understand those cases? What were they doing?
I think they really break into two groups. The first group is there's no discussion by the defendant's lawyer, petitioner's lawyer often, that in fact it has to come to that. And normally when it comes, the other cases that the Attorney General cites, and I cite some of them, there is no conversation about that at all. It simply usually is later in the business when the defendant, usually having blown a period for appealing, seeks some other kind of relief. And so there is really no substantive discussion of what is the standard by which the State may secure additional time. But it does appear from the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Gonzales 2 years ago that 60B does apply in habeas, and therefore its requirement of excusable neglect would be required. I don't think it's sufficient for a district court judge just to say, you know, it's a mistake, let it go. Otherwise, it really does make some mockery of the order that said you shall release. I mean, it wasn't.
What about the pertinence of cases dealing with injunctive relief and the modification of injunctive relief? It seems to me that that's probably the best analogy, because this essentially is injunctive relief. And there is a whole line of cases there that neither of you seem to have cited. I don't know that they're literally 60B cases. Maybe they are, but they tend to deal more with changed circumstances or other kinds of reasons other than excusable neglect for changing the order.
Well, the Court is certainly correct. Neither I nor the Attorney General address those matters to you, so I confess some ignorance. But I think they're really different. I mean, there certainly is a relatively well-established body of case law for habeas. And as the Court is aware, the tradition, until not that many years ago, was simply the Court ordered, vacated the conviction, and remanded the matter back to the State Court for proceedings. As an accommodation to the State, courts have now more commonly issued conditional writs. The Court orders a relatively prompt response, if the matter can be corrected, or the defendant's release. That's what it did here.
So let me ask you some practical questions, because I was very confused as between the parties, exactly why you think any of this matters here. Now, is your position that if he were released tomorrow, because we decided that the excusable neglect didn't work or that it wasn't an appropriate order, could the State retry him?
Yes. This Court can order what it deems equitable under habeas, but I have not asked that the State be barred from retrying Joshua Harvest in Contra Costa County, and I believe it could.
But you did protest vigorously the issuance of an arrest warrant to restart the murder proceedings while he was after it became apparent that they hadn't released him when they were supposed to, and you regarded that as a sham. So why isn't this the same? Why wouldn't this be? I don't see why they couldn't do it, but you seem to think that there was a problem with that.
I do, Your Honor, because I believe double jeopardy unequivocally forbids.
And that's what I'm trying to understand. Why would that be double jeopardy and this not be double jeopardy?
Because the traditional view has been that when an appellate court undoes a conviction, it is not – double jeopardy principles do not bar the retrial absent insufficient evidence.
So it's a difference between doing the same case and starting over again?
Well, I would agree. The State could start over again. The State could dismiss, or this Court could order the dismissal of the pending proceedings. Under California State law, the State, in fact, is entitled to re-prosecute him, because under Section 1387 and related sections in the Penal Code, the State is allowed more than one shot, absent a finding of insufficient evidence. No such claim is made here. So were this Court to say, we're ordering the release of Mr. Harvest and you are barred from re-prosecuting him on this prosecution, the State could file a new complaint in a Contra Costa County and commence proceedings to try him. I do not believe.
You didn't claim double jeopardy.
No. Not in California, because you have not made a finding of insufficient evidence.
So I don't understand what was wrong with what they were trying to do to cover their bases at the time they were trying to do it.
Because they actually had, still in effect, because of the conditional order of the district court following your order, he in fact was sitting in prison following the conviction, and they filed a new charge based on the exact same proceeding.
It hadn't been dismissed yet, that's what you're saying.
Right. Well, the Attorney General conceded it was only to keep him in jail. Excuse me, I didn't mean. Only to keep him in jail. And that was his sole purpose, and it was clearly in violation of double jeopardy. And as soon as that claim was made in the trial court, not only did the State say, we don't oppose that, the Court found that it was.
And also, if he were released, they could also change his sentence and rearrest him for that reason.
One of the issues that does come up in these decisions is to what extent the Court can order release, which becomes really walking to the courthouse gate and being rearrested. And there are some decisions, I think Burton versus Johnson from the 10th Circuit, simply said, we're not going to have that. If we're ordering release, that person's released until there is a new order of commitment. The Court may recall this is also, I believe, a murder case.
I see what you're saying. So you're saying they couldn't hold him in prison pending the proceedings, but they can go ahead with the proceedings.
Yes.
And once the proceedings were concluded, they could then arrest him.
Right. If he were tried and convicted, the judge could remand him into custody. If the judge is going to impose a sentence, the judge could sentence him back into custody. But
the notion being that what's really being governed at this point is his custody status, not really his judicial status.
There are really two pieces. One is certainly his custody status. The second one I argued in my papers is that the State was given an option by this Court in the prior proceedings to simply reduce it from first to second degree murder. It was an option that I argue essentially the State forfeited when, after 60 days, it had done nothing. And again, it seems to me that that's an appropriate response to the Court. Indeed, the Attorney General says in his papers, habeas really allows the Court to do anything that's equitable. And indeed, there are many cases to that effect, including some from the circuit. And it seems to me that this is a case where the State is different than the other excusable neglect cases that come before you. The cases that this circuit has decided, such as Kyle and Committee v. Yost, usually involved a party seeking something for itself. Here, the obligation of the State was to prevent further harm to the defendant. It's really quite different. When someone says, I
don't understand the answer to the question of whether you are agreeing that the State could resentence him, assuming they release him, could resentence him and then he would go back into custody or not.
You see, retry him or resentence him?
Sometimes yes and sometimes no.
Sir, I'm confused about the Court's question. Is it to retry him or simply
no.
to resentence him?
I asked first retry, but now I'm asking resentence.
It is my request in the papers that this Court should not allow him to reduce from first to second-degree murder. If the Court rejects that, then, in fact
– what would be the theory for that? I mean, it seems to me that you have a coherent theory if you say, well, they were supposed to release him, so they have to release him, and then they can go ahead and do what the Court said they could do, and then they can bring him back into custody again. But I don't see why you would distinguish between the retrying option and the resentencing option for that purpose.
I believe there is a distinction that I've tried to point out in my papers where some courts have done just that. That is, they've adopted more than just a release order. In some cases, they have simply dismissed this action, not barring further prosecution on another docket. In some cases, they've barred any further prosecution. In these circumstances, I have not asked you to bar any further prosecution completely. Maybe I'm in error in doing so, but I have not sought that relief on behalf of Mr. Harvest. But I do think the Court allowed the Attorney General something special by allowing a reduction from first to second-degree murder. It was to exercise that option within 60 days. It failed to do so. And therefore, I'm asking the Court to withdraw that as an option for them, leaving in place, if they wish, a retrial of Mr. Harvest on the charge that he committed a first-degree murder. The jury would then decide what should happen.
Okay.
I've used my time.
Thank you, Mr. Hearing.
I'd like to have a minute or two, if I may.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning. Jeremy Friedlander for Respondent. I think there are two issues here. The first issue is there authority in the district court for retroactively extending time after that deadline has passed, even though, by definition, the conditional writ becomes unconditional when...
Well, there seems to be some common ground that, yes, and it's Rule 60B of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, because that provides for amending final judgments in general under certain circumstances, but you have to meet the circumstances. Are you arguing that, or are you arguing some other basis for authority?
The answer is I am arguing that, but I don't agree that there's common ground with Mr. Sugarman's position. I think he would take the position, although I'm not sure about this, that there, once that time expires, the district court lacks authority, and you don't look to this equitable notion. Now, maybe I'm misunderstanding it.
I thought we clarified that, but maybe not.
Let's suppose I'm wrong, okay? I don't think there are two lines of authority here. I think there's an overarching way to harmonize it and say, yes, the district court does have authority to do it if it's equitable under the 60B procedures, unless the extension would itself be a constitutional violation. And I think that what appellant is really suggesting here is that 60-day period was itself a constitutional right that he had.
I understand him to be saying something much more modest, which is that if you use the Pinkay or Pioneer standards and ask whether or not or whether he's saying it or not, let's proceed on that premise, that we're going to use the Pioneer or Pinkay standards,
right,
and we're going to decide whether there was an excusable neglect. Now, first of all, the district judge here, there's no evidence that he did use those standards. He just said, you know, in passing that it was excusable, but he didn't give any indication of why the fact that you let something sit in your desk for 100 days and just forgot about it, or however many days it was, meets those standards. He maybe, you know, maybe he could, you know, there seems to be under Pinkay now a great deal of deference to the district court, and maybe this could have been explained, but as a minimum, there's no explanation.
No, there isn't. It's not my understanding that there that it is required that there be explanation in order to get deference. I'm happy to.
Why would you say this was excusable neglect? I mean, in go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think I have 3 points to make on that on the prejudice question. Okay. There was no prejudice. There was no danger of prejudice. Petitioner comes here and says the danger of prejudice is if you had moved timely, then I could have gotten resentenced in a timely fashion. And if I had gotten resentenced in a timely fashion, I could have gotten a concurrent sentence. And if I did get a concurrent sentence, then I was parole eligible. So your delay has deprived me of a timely parole eligibility hearing. And we responded to that in a number of ways. I'm not going to go through them all, but I will highlight the very important one because the appellant doesn't address it. And that is this court, that is to say, this trial court has shown us that that is an empty claim. When this case was originally before the trial court on remand from the state appellate court, which said we don't have a second-degree murder here in the one case. We only have a manslaughter. The trial court said, I am now going to change your sentence from a concurrent sentence to a consecutive sentence. Why? We don't know exactly why, but it was probably because he wanted to give this man the maximum. And he had already given him the maximum with an LWOP, and when the LWOP was thrown out, he gave him the maximum with consecutives. So for appellant to stand here and say, well, now we've got reduced culpability because it's a second-degree murder, and the reduced culpability might persuade the trial judge to change this to a concurrent sentence is not only wrong but unsupported.
Why isn't the prejudice simply that he remained in – he was supposed to be released – after 60 days, if X did not happen. X did not happen, and he was not released. Why isn't the prejudice simply that he's in custody when he wasn't supposed to be in custody for the time period between when you should have acted and when you did act?
He was supposed to be released.
Under the habeas order. I'm not talking about under the underlying order, but under the habeas order, if you didn't do X within 60 days, you were supposed to be released.
Right. And
didn't
what
do X, and there are reasons for that. I mean, one is, you know, you have to get on with your life. He does. And also, as pointed out, I mean, the former form of order was simply to have release, and the conditional was essentially an accommodation of the state's timing, and then the state doesn't do that. So why isn't the prejudice he was in jail for 60 or 80 more days than he should have been?
Because he would have been immediately rearrested. That's why it was not prejudicial. We had the right to do so, and we would
question.
Have done so.
I mean, I don't know the answer to that question. As I understand Petitioner's position, is that he couldn't have been rearrested. And that makes some sense to me, because what the habeas did was release him from custody. You could proceed against him, and once the proceedings went forward, you could then arrest him. But to arrest him on a pretrial sort of a basis when you ran out the 60 days that you were supposed to be able to do that in doesn't seem quite right to me.
I can't address that further. I will simply assert that he could have been arrested. That's my understanding from the prosecutor. I have not looked at it in great detail, but I
you could have instituted the proceedings, I suppose, and then arrested him. But I find it hard to believe that it wouldn't be a violation of an order that he not be in prison that you then go and arrest him again.
Well, we would have instituted proceedings because
right.
We instituted proceedings immediately upon finding this out.
All right. So at that point, I presume I don't know this, but perhaps you could have rearrested him.
Okay, that's the prejudice question. Okay, now on the fault question, is there a good reason for having screwed up as I did? appellant continues to confuse the distinction between a conduct that is negligent and negligence that is excusable. When I said to the district court, as I say now, my conduct was professionally inexcusable, I was conceding that I acted negligently. I never conceded or suggested that I conceded that negligence was inexcusable in the larger context. Enough said about that. I just think that distinction needs to be clear.
Except that you have Pinkay was a very hard case, as the opinions suggest. But the difference there, it seems to me, in terms of the excusability of the neglect, was that essentially there they had a system that screwed up. Here it appears you had no system. You simply put it on the side of the desk and it got lost. Does that make any difference in terms of the excusability of the conduct?
I don't think it does. For the record, that's not what happened. What happened was that I didn't lose it or put it on the side of the desk.
I didn't think I had to do anything.
Right. And I was foolishly incorrect because I didn't read.
But in general, the state, not you personally, but the state had no system for communicating these orders to the person who needed to get them.
It did have a system. It had this, relied on me, and that system was obviously flawed because I didn't understand what I needed to understand. So I don't think it does make a difference. But, of course, I think that the factors in Pinkay, as I recall, it was not an abuse of discretion to – well, I'm getting confused. I don't remember the holding. I don't think – the bottom line is that I don't think there's anything in Pinkay that suggests that the district court here abused its discretion in granting it. And I think all the cases have suggested that – The court certainly has that authority to do so unless there is that constitutional violation. And that's the point about the final point about the question of good faith and bad faith. The appellant does not contest that there was any bad faith in the failure to meet the 60-day deadline. He finds bad faith in what we did afterward. And again, I may be misunderstanding, but it seems to me his position requires one to believe that we knew there was a constitutional violation here and we thumbed our nose at this constitutional violation. And that is to say that there was a constitutional violation in failing to act in 60 days. And we plainly did not know and did not believe that there was a constitutional violation in failing to act in 60 days. And we acted in good faith with what we thought the law allowed and what our obligations as public servants to protect the community required.
I mean, isn't there a sort of deterrence problem here? I mean, if we continue to allow these retroactive changes, at what point do our orders become or the orders of the district court become, you know, not worth the paper they're written on in these habeas cases?
I don't think there is a deterrence problem because I don't find
it was surprising to me that there are just lots of these cases out there, not only, you know, with California, but in general. I mean, it just seems to happen a lot.
I'm aware appellant has brought up one other case in which it happened.
No, I said I'm not talking about, but, you know, there are a fair number of decided cases in which states were supposed to release people and didn't and then went and got a retroactive order.
Well, the deterrent effect is what I'm going through right now, okay?
Having to be here.
Having to be here and having this whole delightful case when I could have been doing better things. If anybody thinks that that's not a deterrent, then they just haven't been through it. And I'm not suggesting that this is the worst thing that's ever happened or could happen, but it certainly is embarrassing, and it seems to me that's a deterrent.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That's helpful.
Good
Your Honor, I would like to make 3 points in response to Mr. Friedlander's comments. First, I actually think that he's been very enlightening, although he's made a new argument here, about what he thinks of excusable neglect. It's meaningless. His view is that once the Court issues the order, it can do whatever it wants unless there's a new constitutional violation. He believes that's my position, which it's not. It seems to me, rather, what the Supreme Court said in Gonzales 2 years ago, and this Court has said in Pinkay and other decisions, yes, you can get relief under Rule 60B, which he expressly relies on, but it's limited to certain circumstances, and we look at certain factors. So what he's basically saying is, look, if I come in here and say, look, I wasn't trying to...
Well, what about the prejudice point? This case is unusual in that way because of the nature of the order, which was to allow a conversion to second-degree murder, which ordinarily there will obviously be prejudice because a person presumably the order usually will be retry him or else do this. And ordinarily, if there's going to be a retrial, there's at least some chance that he's going to win, and there would be prejudice. But in this instance, the prejudice seems much less obvious.
I disagree in two regards. One, you yourself pointed it out. Mr. Harvis is entitled to his release from state prison under the order of the court. The Attorney General concedes that under the state rules, he would have been eligible for parole if he got a concurrent sentence beginning in 2003, which means in 2005, when this order was issued, 2 years and 4 months ago when it came to fruition, he could have been released on custody. And again, I don't have the burden to show prejudice for excusable neglect. The State has the burden as the moving party to show no danger of prejudice, and the best that Mr. Friedlander could tell you was the trial judge probably wanted to give him the maximum sentence. Well, that doesn't eliminate a danger of prejudice. To the contrary, it confirms there's a danger.
I found that out a long time ago. That's the other problem, because you've been objecting to having the resentencing go forward. It could have gone forward, that we would have found it out, and there would have been a debate about it. And I assume that's why it hasn't gone forward.
But there's really quite a difference between him applying to the parole board and all of its idiosyncrasies and questions of balance and being entitled to release under a district court Ninth Circuit order. Under one, it's very clear, I appeal to the three of you or to Judge Ware, he's ordered release. The parole board is an entirely different kettle of fish with a whole different set of discretion. So I think there really is a danger of prejudice beyond the fact that he's been kept in custody, the fact that he could have had the State acted promptly. But in either case, even though this is an unusual order, as you say, the basic structure of the conditional order was no different than most. Release if you don't do something within 60 days.
Prejudice and inquiry is different.
But
thank you very much for your argument.
May I just make one last comment, Your Honor?
About 20 seconds.
Done. The Court rightly noted this is not the only time. I cited to you Curry versus Andrews.
Right.
It is a question of deterrence matters. And one last thing. While I don't minimize the embarrassment of a lawyer coming before you saying, I screwed up, we should remember that Joshua Harvis is still in prison. That is something that matters, and I think the Court should respond to.
Thank you very much. We are going to take the case of Harvest versus Gonzalez. No, Harvest versus Castro is submitted, and we are going to take a recess. Thank you.
Thank you.